So, why bother about that? It's because differential rotation is found in many astrophysical objects. Here I just mentioned stars and accretion disks. Of course, I'm not dealing with differential rotation which is induced by strong convective turbulence. This is a problem of its own, which is probably harder than what's going on in stable zones. So in the radiation zone of stars, in general, the rotation is differential. Why is that? It's because differential rotation is sometimes imposed by the convection zone itself. We see that in the Sun, just below the convection zone. Or else, differential rotation can be induced by the meridian circulation. That happens probably in fast-rotating stars. In accretion disks, of course, there is differential rotation because the motions are nearly concave. So our claim is that such differential rotation may produce shear instabilities, which then generate turbulence, and that turbulence reduces the differential rotation star. That's how it acts. That it can, of course, operate in non-magnetic disks, where one looks for a cause of the viscosity and for the stellar disk, for instance. And our claim is that even in magnetic disks, it will compete with the other powerful linear instabilities which have been discovered. And who knows, may even overpower them in one of God's in the realistic regimes of Reynolds number. So what do we know about those instabilities? Well, the problem of linear instability is well known. It's an old, very old problem. One knows that when angular momentum decreases with distance from the rotation axis, then there is an instability towards infinitesimal axisymmetric perturbations. This was established by Rayleigh in 1916 and then worked out for viscous flows by Taylor in 1923. It was extended to spherical geometry, so in a stable stratification, applying for stars, for instance, by Solberg and Hoyland at the end of the 30s. And for non-axisymmetric perturbations, this is an error here, Rayleigh has shown, of course, that there is a linear instability when you have an extremum in the vorticity profile. This was he established that for plane parallel shear flow, but the same date, which was 1880, he mentions at the end of his article that it's easy to show that this happens also in cylindrical flow. He doesn't give the demonstration, but it seems to imply it's trivial, and it is, of course. So the problem is that in
inflection point.
Yes, exactly. It's an inflection point instability. Yeah. And Watson, rather recently, has also looked at the problem when you have differential rotation in a sphere over latitude, say, and he came up with the same criterion, namely that you need a local extremum in vorticity to have the linear stability for non-axisymmetric perturbations. However, in most astrophysical flows, the angular momentum increases outwards, and there is no extremum of vorticity. So we have no linear instability. And the question arises whether there can be finite amplitude instabilities in that case. So the question has, of course, been addressed, and recently with numerical simulations. Those performed by Bissoli and collaborators have not shown this instability when the angular momentum increases outwards slightly, very slightly. You see, the logarithmic gradient is only 5% here. Above that 5%, they lose the instability which they have at marginal stratification of angular momentum. And their claim is that it does not exist because rotation stabilizes the instability. So the question is this due to lack of resolution in the numerical simulations? At which Reynolds number would we expect that instability to occur? And the only way to answer that question right now is to look at the laboratory experiments, and it's the old classical Couette Taylor experiment, of course. So why is it called the Couette Taylor experiment? Because Couette was the first one to set up such an experiment, and he did that just to measure viscosity. That was his purpose. And it was at the end of the 19th century. Taylor in 1923, I think it was his PhD thesis, no? Not sure. No, it was not. It was later on then. He did a wonderful work because he carried out the linear instability analysis with viscosity. And this is the theoretical curve which is shown here. And he set up an experiment which is shown here, where you have basically two cylinders which can rotate at different speeds. You see the pulleys here. In between, in the gap, there is a liquid which is water in this case. And you see that the experimental points fit very well the theoretical curve which he had predicted. This is the line which corresponds to zero gradient of angular momentum, the neutral flow. So one knows from non-viscous analysis that above that line you may find linear instability, and the viscosity just changes that slightly, asymptotically of course, one goes to that line here, but one needs has to go for some threshold in Reynolds number to have instability. When the two cylinders, well, this is the rotation of the outer cylinder, this is the rotation of the inner cylinder. When the two cylinders are rotating at different speeds, at opposite speeds, then of course there is a point where there is zero velocity, angular velocity in the fluid. Therefore, automatically the angular momentum has to increase from zero to something in one part of the domain, and one is in the case where one has the linear instability. So that's no surprise here. But you see that fit is really marvelous. That was in 1923. We had an experiment which had 4 centimeters in radius for the external cylinder, a very small gap. And the Reynolds number which was achieved here was of the order of 32,000. Here what is plotted is omega over mu, which is not a non-dimensional number here.
And for what you are showing is the original Taylor experiment?
Yes.
Or is it the modern one?
No. It's the paper in 1923. Very clean. This is really a splendid work. So a few years later, he went back to that experiment, and he wanted to measure torques and to follow the instability in the linear regime. This was a linear instability, just very small perturbations. And he was not able to measure that torque when the two cylinders were rotating simultaneously at different speeds. So he focused on the two cases where the inner cylinder was at rest and the outer cylinder was at rest. And he looked first at how instability would behave as a function of the gap, because he could measure the gap here. And this is his plot here. So the torque is measured just by putting a weight, you see, on the cylinder which is at rest. And by changing the weight, he would keep that cylinder at rest, and the other one was turning the pulley. So here are the points that he heavily measured. This is the Reynolds number based on gap width and difference of rotation speed between the two cylinders, only the speed of one of the cylinders. This is the relative gap, so delta R over R in logarithms, as you can see. And he varied that from something which is of the order of 120s or so to up to, I don't remember how much it was, -0.06. That's about a quarter or so. Huh? And what he got was that the Reynolds number for the instability was increasing for, you see it's about stable here. Here he put a measurement which was done by Coates for even a tinier gap that he had. And this was rather flat here. And when you have a gap which is greater than about 120s, then the Reynolds number increases like that. So that was his finding here. And about the same time, a little earlier in fact, German Fritz Wendt had a similar experiment, but he was able also to measure the mean velocity profile in the gap, because he had a free surface, and therefore just from the shape of that surface he could measure the pressure, and the pressure is indication of course of the centrifugal force in the radial direction. So he could derive the profiles. So you have a better profile.
Quantitatively, actually, similar to the case of a non-free surface?
Yes, otherwise it's similar.
Yeah.
Well, we have to talk about the boundary conditions, of course. Also. So he had, Wendt had three gaps here. The widest one was wider than in the case of Taylor. It was 0.7. The ratio of the radii was 0.7, therefore the gap width was 0.3.
Can you explain what is now what?
This is the scanning gap, the radius here, and this the velocity of the two cylinders here.
So the gap is fixed?
The gap is fixed. Three gaps, the gap is fixed.
So what is changing?
What's changing the relative velocity, relative speed of the two cylinders?
R.
No, no, this is R in centimeters here. It's just the distance from the rotation axis. So he had a much bulkier experiment because his outer radius was 14.7 centimeters, whereas Taylor was slightly less. Yeah, just in the gap.
When you have
it, the
transition, the turbulence,
the profile changes. Well, I don't want to discuss that in detail, but you can see that, and I'll come back to that. So he really scanned the whole plane and had opposite speeds and whatever. I will show you that in a moment. Just going through the history then. In 1965, Coles went to the same problem. And he was very much interested in the I think, I'm not sure about that, but perhaps Wendt, you could not see through the experiment, just indications from the profiles, from measurements, but there was no in situ measurement. Coles had an outer glass cylinder, therefore he could really look what was happening. And he was mostly interested in the case of counter-rotating cylinders here. And what he found is that this is the region of laminar flow where it's stable. You have a region where the flow is completely turbulent. And what he showed, there was a region between the two which were turbulent, was intermittent. Therefore, there were regions where there was turbulence, others where there were no turbulence. And in some cases, those regions would organize themselves as a spiral, a barbopole kind of pattern. So after that, well, but have a look here, you see what the Reynolds number that he reaches here, the biggest one, is 80,000. And therefore, he was aware of Wendt's work, and he produces that picture here of Wendt's result, Wendt's torque measurements. And so Coles goes up to about here, and Wendt, of course, had, because of this bigger apparatus, could reach higher Reynolds number. So he shows that this is again the speed in Reynolds number of the outer cylinder. Inner cylinder is plotted this way, or here. And what is plotted here is the ratio between the torque, which is measured, and the laminar torque. And this plot is misleading, because it does not suggest that this is a finite amplitude instability, which was shown by Wendt Wendt has shown that the threshold that you get when you come from the stability region or when you come from fully turbulent part, you have not the same critical Reynolds number, but you have some kind of hysteresis, and therefore this is an indication that you have a finite Andean instability. So in reality, what you should see here is some kind of a cliff. There should be really a cliff here and not a smooth transition to the laminar flow, which suggests that here finite amplitude instabilities, finite amplitude perturbation will give rise to the instability. So there's probably an overhang here, and this is the same here.
In view of astrophysics, we should actually always be looking, of course, at the right humps of
We are looking here. This is our region of interest, because the angular momentum does not decrease.
So is he then for the first time the one who has actually this extra bump?
This here, yes. This overhang here, and therefore that bump here, yes.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's...
That was Wendt, and Taylor also. Taylor has that also. I come back to that, Axel. Just to mention a few more recent works. This is, again, a work in the group of Sweeney at Austin, where they scanned the whole plane, and they looked for all the patterns, and they were very excited about that, so they described them and give them names. So they have spirals, wavy spirals, interpenetrating spirals, intermittency, and, of course, above some line, what they call featureless turbulence.
I'm a little confused about the previous picture and this picture, for example.
Just this one here?
Yeah. Near the axis there. I don't understand.
Which one? This?
No, on the right, top right.
Yeah. Oh, this is just the same by symmetry, you see. You have that piece which comes back here.
Yeah.
When you are here, the two have negative velocities. That's equivalent to having both. Yes. Just symmetrized again.
But Sweeney apparently misses that point, doesn't he? Or is it actually also in Sweeney's plan? Can you show us again?
Well, they don't go far enough for that see. Yeah.
Okay.
So only one saw that. Coles had not seen it. Well, Coles. No, I take it back. Coles saw that also. But no, the gap widths are not the same, and that depends on gap widths also. So he has that. He has that overhang also. He has that also.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the picture. What's the vertical axis represent? All right.
And then you have inserts where he focuses on one. And one of the most recent work on the subject, but that's strictly only the linear instability case where the outer cylinder is at rest, inner cylinder is rotating. That was done by the group of Sweeney again. And what they did, they went up to 10 to the 6 in Reynolds number. And that's quite an achievement, because when you reach 10 to the 6, it means that your experiment produces 1 kilowatt power in viscous dissipation. So you can not go above that, because it's very hard.
I have no idea. Is that a lot? I mean,
a kilowatt is not bad. It's not how you treat yourself at home, but... One of the problems is well, for the experiment is to keep the temperature about constant, because otherwise the viscosity varies.
But what do you care? I mean, if you have something which is not, it's like an iron, right?
And then you feel, smell, and all that. So it was quite a task. But what is very interesting here is the fact that, well, I should have mentioned that, the Taylor instability, the linear instability, manifests itself by vortices. So it's an organized flow where you have stacked vortices in the gap, and you have an advection of angular momentum by those vortices, which are counter-rotating, of course. So this is a picture of the flow when you are in that regime here, what is the Reynolds number? 4,600, about here. And this is one where you are above that transition here. What is this? This is the torque as a function of the Reynolds number here. And you see that it has a slope which increases and which can be characterized by just a d log g by d log Reynolds number. And the exponent here starts at about 1.3 or so, increases monotonously, and there seems to be a transition here where the slope doesn't increase that much, but it has a tendency to go to a power 2. It's 1.8, about here, and it's still increasing. So the guess is that probably the power which is reached for that for the torque here will go to 2 when it's really fully turbulent.
Is there a reason for that guess?
Yes, you will see in a moment that there is some reason, yes.
In the previous omega plot is on the left, it's to the left on the
no,
left.
It's that axis here.
Where is
that? It's this axis here. You are in that regime here, and you just go up, you have the Reynolds number. The outer cylinder is at rest, the inner cylinder is rotating.
So which is part of, I thought it's the right to be a part of the inner one.
No. They looked at that problem here, where the inner cylinder is rotating, the outer cylinder is at rest.
So, then what is G now?
G is the torque. This is the torque here. Well, the inner cylinder is kept rotating, and it's the torque applied to the outer cylinder. So it gives you a measure of the angular momentum transport between the two cylinders. Right? And therefore, the efficiency.
Can you just try that? It's
much clearer if you just write it down.
The definition of G.
Huh?
And that's the starting point. If it's not important,
G is the torque applied to the. No? What do you want to know?
F times R.
Huh?
F times R.
Reynolds number to some power, huh? Which he calls alpha. But that's the result of the measurements.
Yeah,
but the torque is omega times density times radius squared, right? Yes.
That's not
the torque.
Why don't you write it down?
Well, the torque is the force he has to apply to the outer cylinder to keep it at rest.
To stop it rotating, to
keep it at rest. Exactly what Taylor did also, huh? By putting his little weights on the balance there.
So it's just a measurement of the viscosity, really.
Of the angular momentum transport. It's viscous transport only in the boundary layer.
Right. Huh? It's
otherwise, it's turbulence. Yes. Yeah.
It's the angular momentum flux integrated with the
other. Exactly. That's what it is. So this is equal to 2 pi r times the height of the experiment times the angular momentum flux. So that seems to suggest that since you have clearly two regimes here in the exponent, that here you are still dominated by advection. There is still some hint of the Taylor vortices that have just become more turbulent, but that when you have crossed this point here, that you are in a much more messy situation, and that's probably the shear itself, the d omega by dr, which is responsible for the turbulence. Remember, you have such power laws also in convection. You start with the linear instability, you have some slope, and slope has a tendency to become smaller, less steep, when it becomes more nonlinear. And here, it does not go that expectation, the slope becomes bigger. Transport increases in a way which probably you would not have anticipated. It's very easy to show that the slope varies here, that you go to 1.5 or so. But and above that, we will see. So just to come back to Wendt, because he is still the one. It's too long. That's why I can publish that. This is the again in that plot. This is the region that which was scanned by Wendt. This is the experiment where he reached the highest Reynolds number. It was made with water. It was for the gap. Had the relative gap was 0.15. And you see that the measurements of coals here, they were really the inner part of that, and therefore he had not the same results as Wendt. What I've plotted here, so he changes the rotation speed of the inner cylinder, of the outer one. When I put a red circle here, it means that Wendt states that this is turbulence. It is turbulent. Yes?
See, in all these cases, when torque is measured by stopping one of the cylinders, shouldn't the results be quoted always for the case when only one of them is rotating? Why doesn't it
matter? Wendt manages to measure torques. That's right. It's only in the two cases where one cylinder is at rest that the torque has been measured.
So how do I understand?
These are no torque measurements. They're just visual inspection or for the profiles. He says it's turbulent, or one can guess it is. So when it's red, it's turbulent. And you see, you find that point again, which was indicated in Wendt's rendering. So above that, it's of course turbulent. For different ratio of rotation speed, he gets the turbulence here and here. Here, it's are more dubious cases. From the profiles that he gives, one guess there is extra transport above the laminar transport. But this could be due also to a large-scale simulation, circulation. So I will touch on that in a moment also.
That is Wendt, right?
This is all Wendt.
All Wendt,
except that little box which I indicated the code. All Wendt. And when it's stable, he says it also. Those are clearly the two stable points, and those may be stable too, he doesn't say. And we'll come back to that point here, because he finds a turbulent state when the stratification is neutral here. Which goes not in the picture that Cole's gives of Wendt's result, where one has the impression that on the potential flow, on the neutral flow, there is no instability. Right.
So the point that we should be looking at is now the upper red dotted circle on the right, correct?
Well, all that plane is of interest for the astrophysicists, huh? From that line down here.
Yeah, but not everything, no? Everything? I mean, but you have wanted a slope of 1.5 here.
This is the potential flow here. That depends on, of course, on the ratio of the cylinders. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah, but the slope corresponds to the power law, omega equals psi,
yes.
Minus something. And
yes.
So
the power law here is
two.
Here it's two.
Right.
Here it's two.
Right. So 1.5 is
would be in between here.
Ah, right. So there's no point then. So
there's no point
okay.
So far.
We're looking for Keplerian in this?
Pardon me?
We're looking for Keplerian in this?
I am at least.
We come to that. Be patient.
I was comparing this with Keplerian. In Keplerian, there's gravity.
Yeah.
That's the pupil force. So it's order one important. So
you're saying it's really stupid to think about astrophysics here?
Okay, we come to that. We come to that in a moment.
Why? It would seem that the stability of disk is not obtained.
Yeah, we agree with you. So, but then you should point your head to
Okay, we'll discuss that in due time. Huh? So I come back to a plot which has been I have shown already in the form given by Taylor, namely how the critical Reynolds number that he measures here in the case of the stable angular momentum stratification. So the outer cylinder it's the case where the inner cylinder is at rest, outer cylinder is spinning, angular momentum increases outwards. And what is changed here is the gap width. Okay? And here, the Reynolds number in the classical definition, which is just the R times the difference in the rotation speed times the gap width divided by the viscosity, is given as a function of the gap width here. The black points are the measurements or the determinations from Taylor, and the open circles here are those which have been measured by Wendt. And you see they fit very well. And what you see here is that above a gap width of 120s or so, the slope changes dramatically from a constant here to something which is a slope of 2 in the log-log plane here. Therefore, the critical Reynolds number increases like delta R over R squared. And that means that you can rewrite the Reynolds number as you can factor out the delta R over R squared. And what is left here, which is constant on this asymptote here, is this bracket here, which we call the gradient Reynolds number. So it's defined by the gradient of omega instead of gap width and whatever.
So what's the slope in the... What is the slope of the point that you are at in this on the omega graph?
Here we are in log-log, the slope is 2. Therefore, the critical Reynolds number is like delta R squared.
So you are in the Rayleigh marginal case?
No, this is the case where the angular the outer cylinder is rotating, the inner is not. Strong angular momentum stratification.
So you are
we are on the horizontal axis here.
On the horizontal axis.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, Mike.
Do I understand you say there's hysteresis in this problem?
Well, they don't say exactly what they do. The only one who mentions really hysteresis is Wendt. And therefore, one can really assume that he went from the turbulent region, and what he calls the critical Reynolds number is the one where he loses the instability. It's the smallest, yes.
So what you're focusing on here is the nonlinear instability, right?
Nonlinear instability. So you need a Reynolds of that to trigger that instability.
One asymptote to the other. You are shifting from the linear instability.
Yes. This is clearly the... No. Not the linear one. From the plane parallel instability. This corresponds to a very small gap. You don't feel the rotation anymore, the curvature. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you go to a Reynolds stamp, which is typical of plane shear flow here.
Ah, okay. So it's still the linear instability?
No. We have the case... Angular momentum increases outwards. It's the finite amplitude instability.
Yeah.
That's why Mike asked the question, how was it determined? Because if you come from the stable region, it really depends on how much noise you have in the experiment and how hard you hit the flow to get it. But when you come from the unstable region, then it makes sense. The measurement that you find is something which is probably not dependent on it.
On the top diagram again, back for this, G versus
IE? No.
No. Rough idea
no. We have some, yes. There are some ideas.
Like power one times
time. Come to that. So from these measurements here, it's again the case where the inner cylinder is at rest, outer cylinder is rotating, so the finite amplitude instability. And from the torque measurements, one can deduce something about the turbulent viscosity. So what is really natural in all those cases is to look for a turbulent viscosity, which is given by the largest velocity in the flow, r delta omega, the largest dimension, which is delta r, and you bring in some coefficients, which you call alpha, and that's exactly what Shakura-Sula had to do for the viscosity in accretion disk. By assuming that there is a maximum, they cannot trespass. So that was the work of Denis 2 years ago. He, from the torque measurements from Taylor, the black points, and from Wendt here, he determined the alpha as a function of the gap. And here again, the slope is changing, of course, but when you approach a large gap, then the slope seems to tend to minus 2 in that log-log graph. And therefore, this indicates that nu t doesn't scale as was indicated here, but as, again, delta omega over the delta r, the r cube being just there for dimensional reasons. So it seems that the turbulent viscosity scales like that, and the omega profiles, which are very hard to guess from what Wendt gives, they're compatible with the fact that indeed in the flow itself there's a local turbulent viscosity which scales exactly the same way but with the local values of the gradient here.
Can you just remind us of the definition of Re star, not from the previous transparency?
That's not present here, but R star would be this character here divided by nu.
No, I'm just asking you, I mean, this R cubed, the omega by the R, that features in the definition of...
That's right.
So
this divided by nu is the R star.
So
it's a gradient
the local,
radius.
The local, the turbulent version of this...
You can say that.
Is one.
Yes.
Sort of
yes. Yeah. Yes.
So measuring nu t is... obtained by measuring G, is that right?
G, that's right. And looking at the profile also.
Can you maybe explain how you do that?
Yes, I can probably. Well, I guess the torque. Torque which is measured is, of course, I have to multiply by the area here, 2 pi r times the height, and nu t well, shall I write it in the...
Okay, I can measure that.
The angular momentum flux, say, is equal to nu r cube
so really
d omega by dr,
right?
And we are looking for nu t here, which gives us the torque which is measured for the angular momentum flux.
Yeah. But do you really have omega as a function of radius then?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And how does that
we have the torque, we have omega,
yeah,
the slope, and therefore we can... We have the overall slope that's easy to measure, of course.
Yeah.
What is more difficult to measure is the local,
yes,
the local slope here.
Yeah.
So I say it's compatible with that local viscosity, but we have not enough details. Remember, there were a few points only in the scans that Ben gives.
I mean, the worry, of course, would be, and maybe you will address that, is that you have the boundary layer somehow, and that the slope is not uniform at all.
It is not. At the boundaries, of course, you have viscous boundary layers, and therefore the slope is higher there. It's in the middle where the slope is
right,
smaller.
So we
okay?
Slope in the middle, of course.
Yes.
And so is that the slope that you're actually calling, or is that actually different from the? I mean, that must be different from the
layers. This is the slope. That's something. This is a firm result here. This is more difficult because you have really to look at the profiles, and Denis scanned those profiles. But you see, the points which are measured here are just those was on point. So yes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, or so in the profile. Mm-hmm. It's a clear indication of viscous boundary layers here.
Yes.
But it's hard to...
The effective Reynolds number is much smaller in the boundary layer because yes. you have a large velocity difference.
Yes, so yes.
It seems a little bit unclear, the scaling with Reynolds number, because the effective Reynolds number is not the same as the Reynolds number for the large...
Exactly. The Reynolds number which we really introduce here is the one of the whole domain, of course. Like you define a total Rayleigh number for convection, the local one is different, of course, because the gradient is different.
But there are some things that seem to depend on Reynolds number scaling, and that's for the whole apparatus rather than for the boundary layer.
That's right. So let me come to the point which has been raised already. Can we say something about Keplerian flows? Yes? That's that.
Yes, since all these things look...
That's U, so I should divide this by R.
Par R, yeah, that's
some
right.
Some of these just give a flat omega.
It's never flat.
Yeah,
it's never flat. It's always a slope.
Is it measurable?
Yeah.
What the slope is? How does it scale as a function of our slope?
It's too hard to say that.
Okay, just divide by R. Why is this
so hard? No, that's clear. We have those profiles. I will show you an example of that in a moment.
I guess you were asking that, right? You were just asking that.
So it's clearly what one has to do with modern experiments is to have that profile with, of course, a lot of definition, which the only information we have is that from the 1930s right now.
So after it makes the transition, which one is that, like from 9 to 10?
So
transition?
This is the zero line here.
Yes.
And therefore, everything which starts here and ends here is a case of counter-rotating cylinders, right? They rotate at different signs. So this corresponds to the rigid rotation here, and here for different omega, and you see the boundary layers which apply here, and therefore in that case known as turbulence here for the two profile here, number two.
So when it jumps from lambda, it goes right to turbulence and not some organized vortex structure?
They don't see that.
They
have not described that. But presumably there is intermittency there. There is probably a region of Reynolds number where the flow is intermittent, and then above some Reynolds number where it's completely turbulent. But
what's actually the curve for 10? I mean, what is actually the number meaning?
What is changing? 10 corresponds to that velocity for the inner cylinder, which is negative, and the positive velocity of the outer cylinder. So it's the case of a counter-rotating. I have lost that graph which I wanted to show you. So the 10 case corresponds to one of those points here, the red ones on the left here. I don't know which one, but one of those. So now I would like to draw your attention to that point here, which is really went right, looked at the stability on the neutral line when the angular momentum is constant. And he did that for the three gaps, and for two gaps he found the instability. So that's why I call that in a provocative way half Keplerian flows unstable. And I'll explain in a moment why.
But you're on the two line now, so
I'm
Didn't you say you were on the line with two?
I'm here.
Yes.
We're Q is equal to two, yes, you can say that.
So therefore you should say our margin is stable
really marginally stable flows
yes.
that are known to be non-linear unstable, other non-linear unstable, basically.
That's right. Right. That's right. That's right.
So then if you find it unstable, that's fine.
So you said it's in two cases, they were unstable and one more.
For the largest gap, he hasn't found the instability.
Okay.
For the two smaller gaps that he uses, he finds it.
So for a larger effective Reynolds number,
exactly.
It's stable.
He has not found the instability in the Reynolds number that he explored. Okay?
But the heading is not to be good, right? You shouldn't get, you mustn't call it Keplerian.
No. he anticipates too much. So we are in the case where there is a difference of rotation speed, of course. The inner cylinder is rotating at that speed, the outer one at that speed here. And Wendt has shown a case where the angular momentum is constant. In fact, it's very, very slightly increasing with the numbers that he gives, but it's really marginal. So the laminar flow would give that dashed line here. Huh? This would be the laminar response. And what he measures, the point that we really, that Denis has scanned, is that slope here. So therefore you see that there's a region in the middle here where the turbulence has the effect of increasing the angular momentum gradient from zero, and here in the boundary layer is decreasing here. The same effect here, the slope of omega is lowered slightly, and of course it's enhanced in the boundary layers. But you see the definition of the boundary layers, there are not enough points. But here in the middle, that corresponds to a slope of 1.4. And that suggests that with a slope of 1.4, you are able to sustain turbulence.
I think that's not
a
question of not obvious, because of course you're driving the flow from the boundaries here.
Okay.
So
we come to that. In front of the boundaries. Our conclusion is that there is little influence of the cylindrical boundaries, which impose the mean flow. They have to be there, of course, in the experiment. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a differential rotation. And the reason for that is that that gradient Reynolds number doesn't depend on gap. This is one of the indications. The second is that the viscosity, which we have determined, seems also to be independent of gap widths. And when you ask why is that, then it's from the torque measurements where we derive that turbulent viscosity, the local one. You can have a guess on the size of the eddies, because you say that viscosity is due to product VL, as usual, that the velocity of the eddies are presumably L times the local vorticity. It makes sense also when you take a cookie cutter and just take a piece of the flow, the rotation of those eddies is of the order of the local vorticity. When you do that, you find that the relative size, so scaled with the radius, is square root of that beta that we measured, which is 10 to minus 5, and therefore that is of the order of 1 over 300. And therefore for a gap which is larger than 120th or 1/10th or so, that eddy size is smaller than the gap itself. So it's no wonder that it doesn't fill the gap. That does not explain why we have such small scales there. Eh? This we are still looking for an explanation. But the scales are that small, otherwise the transport would be much stronger.
I'm thinking of the analogy to other flows that are driven. Take for example the case of convection. It is often seen that the average gradient of the convection if you drive
yes.
from a temperature gradient at the top and bottom, that the stratification in between is either very close to stable or is even stable, and sometimes even changes the direction. And yet, of course, it's unstable all the time.
In some simulations, it has been shown to,
yes.
to change the sign, but otherwise it's
yes,
flattened.
Right.
It's flattened,
then,
yes.
But then, according to what you are arguing, it would mean, I guess, that you would argue that case. Let's look locally at the simulation. and you can say that that is small enough, so we can forget about the boundaries, and then you would really come to the conclusion that if its structure is stable, it's actually still unstable. Right?
So it only depends what you mean by Schwarzschild unstable.
Angular momentum.
Entropy gradient for the convection.
Yes.
But here, in the analog?
Angular momentum gradient, I think, relative to 2.
That's the point, you see. What I'm arguing is that it's the d omega by dr, which is the engine behind.
Relative to the 1.5.
Yes.
Why 1.5? Because the critical case is 2.
Or linear.
Yeah. 2 is neutral. When q is smaller than that, it's finite amplitude and stable.
Right.
Well, we'll see that. So from those measurements...
Yeah, but don't you see then our concern here?
Which is the concern?
I mean, in this convection experiment, we would come to a wrong conclusion, I guess, or not?
No.
Why not? I mean,
Axel is saying if you measure the local flow, it may not be it will be different from the Schwarzschild flow.
Yes, yes. You can see that here. You start with a slope which is neutral. No temperature difference, say. If you take the angular momentum as the analog to the temperature in convection, you start from a situation where you have no difference in temperature,
mm-hmm.
and yet you have turbulence. And you increase that gradient. What you decrease is the omega gradient here. This is angular momentum. This is omega here. You start from a flat profile.
Which
is stable linearly.
Yes, I see. Right. Yes, I see. Right. Okay.
Well, okay.
So now we need to see the case where it's getting somewhat steeper, right? Is that the interesting thing?
Yes, of course. Uh-huh. But this information we don't have in the literature.
Right. Yeah.
And Denis will talk about that in a moment.
It's
just the boundary layers here, you see, where the omega slope increases
right,
here.
Right.
Well, it's just corresponding to that, you see. It's the same flow. What is shown here is the angular momentum, specific angular momentum, and here is the omega. So when you have a boundary layer which increases the slope here, it means that the angular momentum is also decreasing faster. So this is really the analog of... what I'm claiming is that when you make an analogy with convection, you are in this case, not in this one. The role of the temperature in that case is the angular velocity, it's not the angular momentum. That's my point. See what I mean?
Yeah.
So I have a question as well here. So on
yes.
the right-hand box, there's this very strong boundary layer.
Yes.
And it seems to be that the flow can only take a certain amount of, for a given viscosity, the boundary layer has to absorb some certain amount of velocity difference.
Yes.
So the width of the boundary layer is kind of set independent of other things, and so you have this big velocity jump up on one side and down on the other, and then over in the intermediate region seems to...
I would reason here, you see, if turbulence would really be very, very active, probably the outcome would be a very strong boundary layer here, a flat profile omega, and again the boundary layer here.
Mm-hmm.
But what determines the thickness is not here. It's the flux of angular momentum. And that is determined by the turbulence itself.
It's
because in the middle here, it's mostly the turbulence which is responsible for the transfer.
The right-hand pitch is a little disconcerting because of the scale on the vertical scale,
yeah,
I think. I mean, it goes from 7 to 1300.
Yes.
It's a lot flat. It's a lot closer to being.
This is very flat here.
No, he's talking about the scale. It's very ample.
You should have used a relative scale because in relative, the
measure is
not
huge, they're not yet.
Very much.
This one is not resolved at all. Huh? This one, you have 3 points in it. But what do you mean by that? It's probably not fully developed turbulence here. we are still in a regime where the Reynolds number is rather small. So it's really what you see in convection when you are a little above the critical Rayleigh number. This is not wide turbulence at all.
The two extreme points are on the boundary?
Yes, of course. Oh, yes. Exactly.
Can you imagine a situation where if there were a body force that would counter the angular, the centrifugal force, which is not a solid surface, so you don't have to worry about the boundary layers, would you predict the same nonlinear and unstable thing?
I don't know.
I mean, of course, that's
a problem,
but we're really looking at boundary layer.
It would be nice, for the accretion disk at least, to mimic something which would have a body force playing the role of the gravity.
I think the absolutely crucial point is, what Jean-Paul is saying, and that's of course correct, is that this top here is already positive.
No, I don't think so. I think it's...
Isn't that a really crucial point?
That's very, very little. I think when we wanted to achieve...
Negative, then we would all, of course, complain. But
now,
because it's positive, you can't.
Right.
So it means.
No, I didn't want to make a point. I think Wendt wanted a neutral situation. But when you put his numbers there, you just found that it's not exactly constant, just by accident, I think. But I wouldn't really look into that.
Yeah, but then, of course, we need to listen to the next Lugar, I suppose.
Okay. So, you see, my first conclusion...
Just a wild question. Is it possible to mimic body pulses with toroids or something?
Which what?
Using something like a ferrofluid to mimic body pulses?
Well, gravity, artificial gravity was mimicked in the Space Lab two experiments. Well, which was convection in a sphere. And
they
had an electrostatic force which gave the gravity. They had the temperature gradient, the radial one, of course, and the whole thing was spinning. So the body force, the gravity, was mimicked by electrostatic force in that case.
But you could get a pretty sizable force on like a ferrofluid, right?
Perhaps.
So maybe you could make a magnetic monopole at the end of a solenoid and make it spread out.
So let me just address another question which has not been raised yet, but it would have been probably. We are more worried about bottom and top boundaries. And the reason is the following. Well, Taylor had two rigid boundaries, and Wendt had a free upper surface. And such boundaries, they drive a large-scale circulation. When this is the case where it's the inner cylinder at rest here, and the bottom is also at rest. This is the outer cylinder which turns here. When the fluid comes in contact of that resting surface, it loses the centrifugal force, and therefore this drives a circulation which looks very much like the Ekman circulation. It is not an Ekman circulation because the fluid is viscous inside, but it's the same, the same mechanism here. So whether you have the bottom attached to the outer or the inner cylinder, you drive the circulation in different ways. And Wendt was aware of that. Here he gives the U profile. So the inner cylinder is at rest. Outer cylinder is turning at the same speed in the three cases. When it rotates with axial, he gets that velocity profile with the interior. That was the velocity profile. And then he was clever enough to split the bottom in two. And that seems to have suppressed more or less the circulation, or made it in two cells. We don't know. This was just a sketch. He has not observed that. He just guesses that the circulation is that way. And therefore, in one case, it increases the angular momentum transport. In the other way, it decreases it. So his trick was to have a split bottom here with half attached to the outer one, half to the inner one. And he gets immediate value. This is just large gap, the medium gap. For the small gap, you cannot distinguish. They have collapsed.
Is the inner cylinder at rest here in this experiment again?
Pardon me?
Is the inner cylinder
at rest, outer cylinder. So it's the finite amplitude instability when you are on the horizontal line in the graph here. Yeah. Okay, so a year ago, I gave a seminar on the same subject and I had to stop here because we had only those measurements and there were loose ends, of course. And my conclusion was then that we needed new experiments. And we had already had contacts with people, but when I was going back to France, I stopped in Austin and I tried to convince Harry Sweeney to run that experiment again. Earlier, I had spoken several times with David Tritton, who was going to Austin, and his plan was to run that experiment again, and in the case where you have definite amplitude instability. I convinced him that it was important for astrophysics. And as you may know, a few months he died there. So that experiment. But the Harry Sweeney told me that it's an exciting problem, but he was excited even more by other problems, patterns in the sand and things like that. And he has limited human resources, so he was not going to do that experiment. And in meanwhile, we had contacts with people in Saclay in France. I just want to and they had made a very nice experiment on the Plain-Couette flow, which you may know, but just in case, I want to describe that for you. What I have done was to have really a controlled experiment where they had really measured the impulse they give to the flow to see what is the threshold of finite amplitude instability. So their experiment goes like that. So the names are Olivier Dauchot and Pierrick Davio, and they are in the physics department of in Saclay. So this is a view from the top. They have a ribbon, a transparent ribbon here, some kind of plastic, which is in the, of course, in differential flow, in differential rotation, because it's motion, excuse me, because of those cylinders here. This is the profile across the flow here. And what I did was to bore two holes in the ribbon, and when they are in coincidence, they can inject some fluid with some speed. The speed depends on the, it comes from a vessel which can be changed in height. And therefore, and so the fluid comes here, goes through, and this provides a finite amplitude to disturb the flow. When there is no such perturbation, then there is no, they don't see an instability. What I see is that depending on the Reynolds number, this is the graph here, they have to give a certain velocity to that injection here in order to trigger the instability. And they measure that as a function of the Reynolds number. And see, when they reach the critical Reynolds number, then this just rockets away here. You need infinite perturbation, whatever. So what do they see? When it's unstable, then after the spritz here, the patch increases slightly and stabilizes itself at some point. And of course, since it moves at the average speed, at the mean speed is zero in that frame, it just sits there and they can look how it expands or contracts. When it's subcritical, then the patch increases first and then contracts and disappears. So you can really visually notice when they have the instability or not.
Does it really contract, doesn't it? It becomes sheared out?
No, it's just the case.
But it must shear, right?
It does not shear because it sits there with the mean velocity of the flow.
The mean velocity of the flow is shearing?
No, the mean velocity is zero here. Because one ribbon goes this way, the other one in opposite speed.
Ah, stuff goes away.
Oh yes, the stuff goes probably in that turbulent patch, becomes turbulent and goes away and becomes laminar again when it goes out of the patch. It's a Lurian patch, not a Lagrangian one.
So if you're saying, if you're looking at that view, you only see a thin layer right near the center, is that true?
I don't remember if they measured that, but it would be that probably.
Because you're looking at the average. That's the question.
Yeah. I don't remember. Do you remember the if they measured the thickness?
I think they just looked from the top, from the glass plate.
That's from the top?
They didn't look across the
mountain. This is looking from the top here. Huh? So they look this way, of course, and they make pictures out. So you see those patches, and their structures are streaks in it and whatever. And when the Reynolds number increases here, the splashes expand more, and therefore the flow, you can say, is more intermittent. The region occupied by the turbulence becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually it will occupy the whole height of the region. So that was the first time where the critical Reynolds number has been measured with such a precision, and it has been shown how... So for astrophysical purposes, it would be nice to see how this scales with a very, very high Reynolds number. We made some guesses with Béranger Dubrulle about that. We think it would scale with r to the power 1/3, minus 1/3. So the message I want to give you here is that we had the impression we had experts there, and we convinced them to set up a rotating quad experiment. And now I give that to. I spoke about the past, and then we will talk about the present and the future.
Can I ask a question? I'm very ignorant of it, but I thought that the carbonates was that carbonates in a pipe or in a carbonates in a pipe. The reason why you have carbonates at all is because something happened in the boundary layer. It's not something happening in the flow, in the boundary layer, and it develops from the boundary layer. In fact, at low Reynolds number, you first have some vortex structure. Well, you have first detachment from the boundary, then vortex streets, and then fluid belt hardness. This is standard flow in a pipe experiment.
One way to provide force perturbations is to have a rugosity on the...
Well,
a rugosity of... have an equal... well, whatever.
Yeah, I only know that.
This is why, of course, when you have very smooth pipe,
yeah,
then you can walk to right.
So we understand that that's where turbulence starts. So we understand that the origin of that is really the boundary layer, nothing else.
In that case, it's the boundary layer. In this case, it was triggered by injection.
There's another aspect, that is how turbulent is the incoming fluid. No matter how quiet you make it, there's always turbulence in the incoming fluid. And therefore, it can be triggered from the inside. It depends on very carefully on how the experiment is designed.
So you mean in other words,
the fluid that's coming in has a certain amount of fluctuation. It's above the thermal level, no matter how far. And that, with a very, very high Reynolds number, can trigger a burst of turbulence, a nonlinear jump of turbulence. Not only the boundary layer.
But is that a burst or it stays forever? I mean, this patch light lives forever.
If you've got a high enough Reynolds number, you can get a nonlinear jump into a turbulent state, just like that.
Yeah, I mean, in this case, of course, it's all verified even by simulations in this particular case, right? So, in fact, it is correct to say that it can be triggered from inside.
No, but you trigger from inside, but is this patch turbulent forever, or this patch is going to die off and dissipate?
No, it's forever.
I mean, this is all
about
accepted, I think.
Okay.
This is
there's no rotation.
And of course, if you go to high Reynolds level here, then presumably you reach a level where the noise in the fluid, because there will be some motors or whatever, will provide that final energy.
And the same is true for the turbulence in the rotating disk you showed before, that the turbulence is starting from some instability inside the flow?
Certainly, yes.
And why not from the boundaries?
Yeah, I think in that case you can have a... Sure.
I think it starts from the boundary because it's the equivalent of flowing a pipe.
It has to come from somewhere. So it presumably comes from the boundary.
I thought it was understood from a century ago that it comes from the boundary and flowing in a pipe. And this differential between this guy is the same thing.
The real question is the following. Let's say we have that regime here. So the finite amplitude regime. When the boundaries are very smooth and whatever, but you mean you have to go very, very far on that diagram before you have the instability. When you have you take the Reynolds number, and it stays there, and the noise is not provided anymore by whatever gave it. It's just the flow is turbulent, it stays turbulent.
So,
my guess at least. And okay. From looking at the plane parallel quest, it seems to be the case.
So, you really don't care who started it?
No. No.
And you hope that in your flow there is some mechanism that is not a boundary layer.
because of the... Could you trigger these things by, say, using a high-power laser instead of using a fluid injection? Why not just...
You mean in situ then?
Right, yeah.
I mean,
this way you would have very, very good control over local energy deposition and to answer a lot of these questions.
Yeah. But you see, they were pretty concerned about measuring the physical value of sample size. And what they observed then, what happens after, the history is independent of the spritz. It's only dependent on the value of sample.
But you know, when you have a jet coming into a fluid, there's a lot going on.
Oh, yes. But you see, this seems to be very, very predictable and clean. No?
Yeah.
And the sulfalinine type of thing on before. Then the other one.
There's this epsilon at this stage, right? I mean, this scaling could be.
I think we should move on to that because we've already had that. Thank you.
I think you will come back in 2 minutes, so you'll see then. You will. So as Jean-Paul said, I'm just going to present a few new results that we did with the team in SACLAC of fluid dynamicists. First, I'm going to show you the experimental setup, the actual experiment. You have a scheme here. So the aspect ratio is you have outer cylinder, glass outer cylinder, with a radius of 5 centimeters. The inner cylinder can be any size you want. The actual extension is 38 centimeters. And I'm going to speak a little bit quickly about the way the team in SACLAC developed a new visualization technique. Actually, the flow is visualized by fluorescent lighting. What you could see maybe here is neon lights, UV lights. The inner cylinder is covered with a fluorescent a film, and the fluid is a solution of water and kaleidoscope, which are little particles who reflect light, little flakes. When the flow is azimuthal, the flakes are aligned on the flow, and then the light from the bottom does not go. The light reflected by the inner cylinder does not go through, and so you have kind of a dark pattern. And once you become turbulent, you're not azimuthal anymore. Then you'll have patches or the old flow, which is much brighter. The pictures are, it's visualized with the CCD camera, which allows to make movies and spatial-temporal diagrams. And the very nice thing is plain mirrors behind the cylinders, which allow to see the hidden side of the cylinder, which means you can see the full perimeter. If you want more detail, there is a preprint just dealing with the visualization. And finally, the temperature of the fluid is controlled by a refrigerated water flow in the inner cylinder. The inner cylinder is hollow. We control the temperature actually here below the cylinders. And what you could see here are that little hole will actually allow us to tune the boundary conditions with adding little disc who could rotate with one cylinders or like two who could rotate with each one. So I was going to make a little bit more PR about the team, because they made a really, really, really nice small gap experiment, very small gap. I think I'll move on very quickly. I don't know if you see what that is, but the gap was less than 1 millimeter. I know that they broke a lot of glass before doing that, And the object was to study the spiral turbulence in the counter-rotating cylinder's case. There is a known regime where you have intermittency, spatial intermittency, and you have stripes of turbulence with stripes of laminar flow. That's really a spiral going, spiral wave moving in the flow. So very quickly, what they show is that they see a continuous transition from the fully turbulent to the spiral and to the laminar flow, which is really a new result. And that's linked to the boundary effect. It was thought before that the spiral would rotate with the inner cylinder speed. It's actually not true. They showed that it rotates at the mean angular velocity. It actually is a hint that everything happens in the bulk of the fluid and not on the boundary layers. And for low inner Reynolds number, they showed patterns exactly like the plane cartellosa did, which means really little patches surrounded by laminar flow. I'll just show that. It's a subliminal one. So you can see the beginning of the intermittency and then the spiral, and you still have some spiral remaining here, and after that you become completely turbulent in the outer Reynolds and inner Reynolds. You can follow the path.
So is that just a picture of a small region of the fluid? Where is the spiral?
Here.
The whole flow.
The whole flow. That's the whole flow. That's what I meant. You can guess here.
Is the camera going around?
No, you can guess here the three stripes. This is the part of the cylinder which is in front of the camera. And those are the two parts who are reflected by the mirrors behind it. And that allows you to have the complete map.
So, when those spirals, are they opposite directed vortices? I mean, or what? I mean, in the tangle flow, the vortices are like that, right?
Yeah.
Now, are you saying that the spiral...
It's not vortices, it's turbulent stripes.
These are turbulent stripes?
These are turbulent stripes.
Oh, they're all turbulent stripes?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. With laminar stripes in between.
Oh, with laminar...
Yeah. Okay. It's kind of turbulent wave. Turbulent wave. And you go when you increase the Reynolds, the actual wave number decrease, and actually the width of the stripe increased too, which you can see here. That epsilon parameter here is actually a measure of the how far you are from the critical Reynolds number, and lambda is this one is a wavelength, azimuthal wavelength of the spiral, and that's the amplitude. And you can see that the more the higher you go in Reynolds, and the spiral will become more and more azimuthal, and continuously you go to complete turbulence, you flow completely turbulent. And that's the graph showing the angular velocity of the spiral versus the angular the mean angular velocity in the flow. And you can see that it's here there's a typo here. This is omega m. It's almost a straight line with a one flow. Anyway, that's really nice, but does not have much interest for astrophysics. Maybe, never know. So we moved on to a wide gap experiment with the aspect ratio of the eta, which is R1 over R2 of 0.7, which means the inner cylinder is 3.5 centimeter, outer is 5 centimeter, with 1.5 centimeter gap. And the height is still the same, which give us a ratio H, which is the actual extension over delta R of 25. The performance is expected from that experiment with the motorization we have. For the Reynolds number, delta omega r delta r over nu, we can go to up to 120,000. And for that gradient Reynolds number we Jean-Paul spoke about, we can go up to 1.4 10 to the 6, which is much higher, of course, than the gradient, critical gradient Reynolds number expected from the early experiment. So what I'll show is really preliminary observations. We started late March, which means 2 weeks before coming here. For now, for that experiment, we reproduce exactly the other one. We did not use the other one. So that's only visual observations. And we went only up to Reynolds of 60,000 for now. We can still gain a factor of 2. So let me tell you a little bit before. How he was hunting the... I'm very proud of that. You can see the lines here. How he was hunting that instability, that the outer Reynolds number, that the inner Reynolds number. What we saw in Vent is, you can guess one over there, is a nonlinear instability domain here, if you remember well. And of course, you'll have here the linear instability. So what I want to precise is, we start from rest, of course, for here increasing the outer speed, and then we'll trigger the turbulence, and we'll go back to find where we lose the turbulence, and that's the point you'll see. And exactly the same for the measurements who are done here. We go from the linear instability, which becomes turbulent fully, really fast, and then increase the speed of the outside cylinder to come from the turbulent, always coming from the turbulent region. This is a solid body rotation. This is unusual flow. Q equal 2, and this is Q equal 1.5. So you find you see here the domain that you could find in Vent or Taylor, except that for the gradient Reynolds number, we're lower than them by a little bit less than a factor of 2. And personal explanation, we cannot ask them, of course, is that I think that most of their results are done without checking the hysteresis. At least for Taylor, I'm almost sure he did not. He did it on one experiment. But most of his results are not. And if actually I don't come back, the turbulence I will trigger it much further, like by a factor of 2. So that region here is turbulent. Most probably fully turbulent here, even if just visually that's not, I cannot see it right now. And when you come back, you become spatially intermittent. Now that that curve, this path, of course, coming from here, so the linear instability here, you can really tell when you're crossing the neutral flow. Because even turbulent linear instability, you can still guess the Taylor vortex flows, or vortex flows, you can really see it. And beside that point, you cannot anymore. And what you see here is the half length of the cylinders, which is turbulent. And you have kind of turbulent patches who go up and down to the boundary layer, top and bottom, and who die there. Which makes me confident in thinking that that's not tricked by the boundary, top and bottom boundary layers. The top and bottom boundary layers in that configuration we have look actually more stabilizing. And I'll say that's a pretty pessimistic measurement, as I really found the point where I guess everybody in the room could say it's still not laminar, it's a little bit turbulent. Other thing, few words about the boundary layers. I did exactly the same measurements, with the cylinder's filled to the top and with a free surface. And those points are the same, do not change. And that's a major difference, because if you have one free surface, then you have that circulation triggered by the bottom, and so you'll have one circulation. If you fill to the top, then you have a double circulation who meet in the middle of the lens. So that's a complete different situation for the boundary conditions, and that's still the same measurement. So, little summary. That's what I said on that axis. We have intermittent turbulence for Reynolds number, critical Reynolds number, a little bit lower than old experiments. In the case of what I call crossed gradients, which means Kipperian-like, where you have a stable angular momentum gradient, but decreasing azimuthal velocity, the bulk is turbulent. And if you want to measure that Q parameter, for a Reynolds number of 15,000, the flow is turbulent till 1.7. Hmm? 1.27, sorry. And just to make a point, if the Reynolds number is less than 3,000, that's the point. Which is that point here. That means you're crossing the line of the neutral flow, of the linear instability. Then, the last Q parameter unstable is 2. Which means if I do numerical simulations, without knowing if my Reynolds number is higher than 3,000, that's the instability, that's the Q parameter I'll find for the last unstable flow.
Where you start on the stable side and move towards the unstable side?
Yeah, yeah.
So what happens then?
That's almost the same. It's almost the same.
But does the line move over to the other side?
Yeah, you do. You do. Exactly like exactly like for that case. You cross here, you will find it further. I can tell you if it's before or after. To be honest, I can tell you I did not do that quantitatively. But what's interesting is to come back. That's the real limit where you can have turbulence. If you're here, I don't mean you're always turbulent, but you can have it.
But it would be very interesting to know if you start from the laminar side.
Yeah.
Whether it's at which side of 1.5.
Which will cross here or later?
Yes.
Yeah.
Depends on the noise.
Be very specific to the experiment. Mm-mm. And so what are the next steps? That's just technical. We're going to use a fast camera to measure the degree of intermittency in the flow, to measure, for example, where we really become fully turbulent. We're going to use laser Doppler velocimetry, which will give us the azimuthal velocity profiles, fluctuations, and time correlations. And what we're going to do is study more the boundary conditions, study the effect that we did not do yet, with different boundary conditions, top and bottom, to see if we keep exactly the same instability lines. And what we'd like to do is to suppress that large-scale circulation, which, even if it's not responsible for the turbulence, would affect the mean velocity profile.
And measure torques.
And measure torques, yeah, that's right. We're going to measure torques, too. Conclusion?
Thank you.
The vertical shear? Vertical gradient and angular velocity?
No, it's radial.
I mean, that is filled up by the meridional circulation somehow.
Yeah, yeah.